So we are in 2 Kings. We are doing the prophets Elijah and Elisha. And we have just finished the Moabite Rebellion, where the Moabites tried to quit paying tribute after Ahab died. And the king of Israel and Judah and Edom all went against him. And they prevailed. I'm not sure whether there's anything left to pay tribute with, the way they destroyed the place. And then from there, we went to the widow with her oil. She was the wife of one of the sons of the prophets, and she was out of money. And so Elijah arranged for her to be able to fill up a great many vessels full of oil and then sell that oil and live on it. And then we have the Shunammite woman, where a wealthy woman set him up with a place where he could stop when he was traveling through. And as a thank you to her, he arranged for her to have a child. And then that child died, and he raised it from the dead. So that takes us now down to 2 Kings 4, we're in 38. Now, one of the things that Elijah does is he floats around a lot. And Elijah came again to Gilgal when there was a famine in the land. And the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, and he said to his servant, "Set on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets." One of them went out into a field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it a lap full of wild gourds and came and cut them into the pot of stew, not knowing what they were. Obviously, experimental gastronomy is not recommended. There are, in fact, lots and lots of poisonous gourds. And for him to just sort of go out and grab some and throw them into the pot is not bright. It would be the way I would say it. It's interesting, but the commentary that goes with my Bible program says, oh, they were just bitter. I was reading quickly on the internet, that font of information, and if you get a gourd that is bitter, you should not eat it. However, the Chinese have a gourd that they call bitter melon that they do eat. I don't know anything about it other than that's what its name is bitter melon, and they have a whole set of recipes around it, and it's apparently a widely eaten thing. So anyway, no idea what the gourds were, but then again, the prophet didn't have any idea either, so we're even. Verse 40, and they poured out some for the men to eat, but while they were eating of the stew, they cried out, "Oh, man of God, there is death in the pot," and they could not eat it. He said, "Then bring some flour." And he threw it into the pot and said, "Pour some out for the men that they may eat." And there was no harm in the pot. Now, in this Bible knowledge commentary written by Dallas Theological Seminary was saying that what happened was the flour cut the bitterness so it didn't taste bad, and that's why they were able to eat it. No idea whatsoever. Question was, if this is not an actual miracle, why is it being reported? Well, there's lots of things that are recorded in the Bible that aren't miracles, and I don't understand why there aren't there either. But they do sort of lend an air of believability to the story. In other words, you have details that are, you know, not major theological points, but they're human points. And so you get the very strong feeling that you're dealing with real people, which you are. So having something like this in there, even if it might not be a miracle, advances the story and makes the characters human. So the prophet didn't know what it is. I don't know what it is. And I don't know that Dallas Theological Seminary knows what it was. But in any case, they were able to eat it. 42. A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, fresh ears of grain in his sack. And Elijah said, "Give it to the men that they may eat." But the servant said, "How can I set this before 100 men?" So he repeated, "Give them to the men that they may eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left." So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left, according to the word of the Lord. And of course, this obviously prefigures Yeshua feeding crowds of people. And the reason that's in there is one of the things that Yeshua does is stuff that has been done by other prophets. So raising people from the dead, both Elijah and Elisha do it, total of three people, and feeding a multitude when there isn't enough food in the natural. That's what Elisha is doing. So for Yeshua to do the same thing is something that should have brought comfort to the Pharisees, that they were dealing with a real, honest-to-goodness prophet because he was doing the same kinds of things that the prophets in their scriptures had done. The question was, where in scripture does it say, give them to the men that they may eat, for the Lord says, they shall eat and have some left. It is not in scripture that I know of. It is the prophet speaking for God. At least that's how I read it. I'm connected to God. It's going to be enough. God says so. Comment was, as I was talking about the things that Yeshua was able to do that should have been comforting to the authorities that they were dealing with a real prophet, to my knowledge, there's no cases where a prophet has opened blind eyes. That was unique to him. And it is predicted in the prophets. So the idea that the Messiah would be able to do that would then set him apart from the ordinary prophet. Not that prophets are terribly ordinary, but you understand what I'm saying. We're now down to chapter 5. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master in high favor, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who was in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord. Thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So you have, obviously, a young Israeli girl who has been carried away as a slave. She would have been carried away from Israel because she knows of Elijah, as opposed to perhaps being carried away from Judah, where he wasn't operating. That's a guess. She obviously is loyal to the family where she is enslaved. She's being treated well, I would imagine, and it's not terribly onerous on her. And she has come to be a member of the family, quote unquote. Certainly never going to be an heir or an heiress, but accepted. And so she actually cares for Naaman and his family. So she gives this advice. So Naaman goes to the king. The king says, "Yeah, go. I'll give you a letter to go with him." Now, the other thing about this, obviously, is at the moment, Israel and Syria are not at war. We'll see later on that they will be at war. It comes and goes. We're at verse 5.5. So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy." And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure him of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me." So Naaman has got lots of money. This is big money. Clothing is not cheap either. 10 changes of clothing is a big deal. And naturally, since he is the commander of the Syrian army, he goes to the king. So it would not be appropriate for him to go rumbling around the country looking for this prophet, because the king of Israel would say, "Why is the commander of the Syrian army driving around my country like that?" There would be, at best, suspicion. Naaman, I'm sure, is traveling with a squad of soldiers at least. So protocol says that if an official of one country goes to visit an official of another country, he checks in with the government, which is what he's doing. The other thing is, it's not clear who the king is here. One of the things about reading Elisha is it seems to not necessarily be sequential. In other words, the vignettes are self-contained. The comment was that certainly would apply to the Shunammite's child because you had a 9-month pregnancy, assuming everything was normal, and some number of years for the kid to grow up enough to be out in the field with his dad. So, as I say, the feel of these vignettes is they're true. I don't have any problem with them being true, but they don't seem to be anchored in the time stream. They just seem to be presented as vignettes. So anyway, the king, being suspicious and having no idea in the world how to cure leprosy himself, thinks that he's being set up, and that king of Syria is sending him an impossible task with the idea that he can then be really grumpy when nothing happens. But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me, that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." I don't know how long Naaman hung around the palace with the king, but for word of that incident to get to Elijah, who's somewhere else, again, these vignettes have this feeling of the essence of the story, but time and distance is sort of compressed. Sort of like the problem I was having the other day when we were going through the Moabite Civil War, and I thought of it later. The narrative of that was obviously written by a scribe, not by a tactician. For example, in World War II, units would keep a unit diary. You know, ships would too. You'd have captain's log and all that kind of stuff. And you could read through there and you would get stuff chronologically and you would get the idea of how much time elapsed and how much distance was traveled and all that kind of thing. Whereas somebody who's simply writing a story doesn't pay attention to all that and just writes the salient events of the story. And I sort of get the feeling that Elijah and Elisha are that way. You've got somebody who's not a tactician and not used to moving people and troops and stuff like that, and he's just writing down the incidents. And I'm not saying that as in I doubt the veracity of the guy. I'm simply saying it feels like he's just written the high points and neglected time and distance. Verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elijah sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go, wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh will be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was very angry and went away, saying, "Behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord, his God, and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper." In other words, he was expecting the prophet to make a show of this. "You're going to be able to cure me of leprosy. I want to see some song and dance in this. I want to get the idea that you're for real." For you just to send your servant out and say, "Go wash," that is insulting to my position. And furthermore, I'm not even sure it's going to work. But mostly it's insulting to me because I have come down here with this big retinue. I have stopped at the palace. I have checked in with the king. I've got all of this stuff going. This is a state visit. And for you to send a servant out and say, "Go wash in the river," that's an insult. And he is highly insulted. The other thing, by the way, speaking of that, go back to the incident of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Remember the showdown at Mount Carmel, where you got two altars set up, you got bulls on both of the altars, and the prophets of Baal are starting first. And they're jumping around, and they're cutting themselves, and they're screaming to their god, and it's a regular show. And everybody's watching and saying, "Oh man, this is serious stuff." Sadly, however, no fire comes down, so it's all for naught. Naaman is a pagan. I suspect that he is probably expecting that kind of a show, if you will, to cure his leprosy. And the other thing to remember about the showdown at Mount Carmel, Elijah didn't do anything. All he did was say, take some water and pour it on this. Seven times, pour some water on this. And then he stood back and said, God, I'm your man. We need fire. And zap, there it goes. There was no dancing around. There was no special stuff going on. It was simply, okay, I'm the real deal. I'm the man of God. We need fire right now. There it is. Just exactly the same thing that he did with the two companies of soldiers that were sent to him to drag him out to the king. So in Elijah's mind, he's a prophet of God, which he was. I said, you're healed, and this is what you need to do. Don't bother me anymore. And that's the end of the story. Verse 12. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. But his servants came near and said to him, my father, it is a great word that the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, wash and be clean? So he went down and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. So everything happened just as Elijah said it would. And his servant, I am sure, is used to dealing with his master when he's in a rage. I was in the army. I was a battalion commander. And the division sergeant major and I kind of liked each other. And sergeant major was talking to me about the division commander one time. And the division commander just came in and stomped around and angry about something. And sergeant major looked at him and says, feel better now, sir? And I sort of get the same feeling from this servant. Well, okay, I understand you're ticked, but why don't you go try and do what he said? Maybe it'll work. So verse 15. Then he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him. And he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant. But he said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Now, you remember when Saul lost his donkeys and they were going to go up to Samuel to see if somebody knew where the donkeys were prophetically? And his servant says, do we have the price of a prophet? In other words, if we're going to go up and ask this guy where our donkeys are, he's going to expect an honorarium. Do we have it? So for Naaman to come back and offer an honorarium to the prophet is not at all out of line. And I sort of get the impression that Elijah just sort of blew him off. Very much in the same spirit of telling him to go wash in the Jordan. You, Gehazi, go out and tell the guy to go wash in the Jordan. No, I don't want any of your stuff. Go back to Syria. As I say, he's kind of a grumpy guy anyway. And I could see how this would annoy Naaman as well, because he is not being respected by this man of God. However, having just been cleansed of leprosy, he seems to be in a better mood. Verse 17, then Naaman said, if not, please let there be given your servant 2 mule loads of earth. For from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but the Lord. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. And he said to him, go in peace. A couple of things, what's going on? You remember when Trump took his staff and went across the street to the Episcopal Church and prayed? So what Naaman is saying is, when the king goes into the house of Naaman, it is a command performance for me. I have to be there. just like Trump's staff had to go with him across the street. You know, it's a command performance. I got to be there. The two mule loads of earth, I am expecting he is setting up an altar to Jehovah, a place where he can offer burnt offerings. Because he says, I won't offer any other burnt offerings except to the Lord. And he says, from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offerings or sacrifice to any god but Jehovah. So I am inferring that he is taking two mule loads of dirt from the land where Jehovah is. In pagan religions, gods were territorial. So you would go to a different place and there would be a different god that was in charge of stuff. One of the things that happened, of course, when the northern kingdom was sanded off by the Assyrians, and the Syrians brought in replacement population, who became the Samaritans, the first thing they did was say, all right, who are the local gods? What do we have to do to worship them? And I don't remember which Assyrian king it was, went to the exiles of Israel and scarfed up a Levite and sent the Levite down to the Samaritans to teach them how to worship the local god. And so the Samaritan Pentateuch is used to this day by the Samaritans, and they worship the same god that we do, and they worship him according to the law of Moses as was given to them by this Levite. Now, the Jews don't accept that. They don't accept that this is genuine, and you know, you have all the stuff in the New Testament where Yeshua goes to Samaritans and so forth, and they all look at him like, what are you doing here? You guys don't have anything to do with us. Anyway, back to Naaman. Since he is going to burn offerings to Jehovah, and he can't come down to Israel to do that, what he's doing is he's taking a load of dirt from the place where Jehovah reigns, and he's going to take it back home, and he's going to make himself a little pad with that dirt on it so that he can then offer offerings to Jehovah in a strange land, but on the dirt of Israel. The comment was, talking about paganism, the gods of the pagans are in fact real, and I agree with that. And they are in fact territorial, and I agree with that. Because as you remember in the book of Daniel, when Gabriel was trying to come to Daniel to answer his prayer, and he was resisted for 21 days by the prince of Persia. So yes, I don't think pagans were stupid. I think that there were or are spiritual entities, and I think that they're territorial. And my point that I was making is not that Naaman's gods weren't territorial to Syria where he lived, but that he thought Jehovah was also territorial, which is not the case. Jehovah is the God of everything. He's thinking of Jehovah as if he were one of the pagan gods who is territorial. So in order to sacrifice to him, I need to take a little bit of his territory and plant it here so I can sacrifice to him and he'll accept my sacrifice. And of course, Jehovah is not territorial and could quite frankly have been sacrificed to anywhere. So we're all the way down to 19 and a half. But when Naaman had gone from him a short distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elijah, the man of God, said, see, my master has spared this Naaman the Syrian in not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi is showing an entrepreneurial spirit here. There's wealth to be gotten, and my master isn't going to get any of it, so I will. Now, one of the things we don't know, just as an aside here, we don't know what Gehazi's status is. We don't know whether he is just a regular hired guy that is a servant, or he may be an indentured servant or a slave. If he is an indentured servant or a slave, it is possible for him to buy his freedom. So one of the things that may be going through his mind is, whoa, there's a bunch of money to be had here. If I can get some of it, I might be able to buy my freedom. That is all speculation. Scripture doesn't say anything like that. He may just be a greedy guy that is trading bitcoins on the side. I have no idea. But the point is, he is greedy, and he does do something that his master said not to do. Verse 21. So Gehazi followed Naaman, and when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, is all well? And he said, all is well. My master has sent me to say, there have just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothing. Now, he's not greedy, because Naaman has got way, way more wealth than that. And the other thing is, he obviously wants to make the story believable. So he's asked for a talent of silver and two changes of clothing. Verse 23, and Naaman said, be pleased to accept two talents. And he urged him and tied up two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of clothing and laid them on two of his servants, and they carried them before Gehazi. So Naaman is, I don't know whether he's got his chariot parked and idling while his two servants truck the silver back. And a talent of silver, I believe, is 77 pounds. So it's a lot of weights. If Gehazi had tried to carry two talents, that would have been like 150 pounds of silver, and that's heavy. So he sends two servants with him. 24. When he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and put them in the house, and he sent them in away, and they departed. He went in and stood before his master, and Elijah said to him, where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, your servant went nowhere. But he said to him, did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence, a leper like snow. As I say, Elijah is a no-nonsense kind of a guy. The comment was, I assume being turned into a leper meant he was also fired, because a leper is unclean. So he would not be able to perform the duties of a servant to a prophet in that state. So yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Good observation. Chapter 6. Now the sons of the prophet said to Elijah, see, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, and each of us get there a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there. So he's got a stable of prophets, not sure exactly where they live, but they want to build a bigger house. And he answered, go. Then one of them said, be pleased to go with your servants. And he said, I'll go. So he's apparently got nothing prophesying on his mind that day, and goes on a walk with them down to the Jordan to cut some lumber. So he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water. And he cried out, oh, alas, my master, it was borrowed. In other words, I have borrowed this axe and I've lost the head, and that is an expensive thing. Worked metal was generally expensive. Not like you can go down to Home Depot and buy another axe for however much they cost these days. And furthermore, it wasn't his. 6. Then the man of God said, where did it fall? And when he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. And he said, take it up. So he reached out his hand and took it. Again, it's one of these time-independent vignettes. It isn't clear when it happened. Verse 8. Once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he was used to warn him. So he saved himself there more than once or twice. I'm not sure what sent to that place means. It does not appear that he attacked the Assyrians. Assyrians were rumbling around trying to get a match with the king and his army. So anyway, this king of Syria is warring against Israel, which means that he's rumbling around in Israel, and one presumes that the king of Israel is not wanting to fight, either because he's not prepared or because the Syrian army is too strong for him. So what he is doing is he is avoiding contact, which is fine. And the king of Syria is really annoyed because he's never able to engage the king of Israel in a decisive battle like he wants to. You know, talking about time shifts, the previous chapter, when Naaman came down, Syria and Israel were at peace. Chapter later, they're at war. And there isn't any time signature on this stuff, so we're not sure of sequence. The other thing I'm not sure of is who the king is. Because one of the things, as you remember, during the Moabite rebellion, when Joram came up to inquire of Elijah, Elijah looked at him and said, "What do I have to do with you? Buzz off. And if it wasn't for Jehoshaphat being with you, I wouldn't tell you anything." Yet here, he saves the king embarrassment at the hands of Naaman by curing his leprosy. And here, you've got the Syrian army rumbling around in Israel, and he is providing information to the king how to avoid combat. So I'm not sure if it's the same king or a different king or what. Anchoring these vignettes in time, I'm finding difficult. Verse 11. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" In other words, who's the spy? We got a spy and a traitor in our camp. And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." Now, how a Syrian knows this, I have no idea. It reads like somebody writing down vignettes in a chronicle kind of a thing, as opposed to somebody who actually is there at the time. Not doubting that it happened, it's just strange. Verse 13, and he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him." It was told him, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. So he has lived in Samaria, he's lived in Dothan, he travels all over the place. And how they know this is not at all clear. So verse 15. When the servant of the man of God, who is presumably not Gehazi, or if this is an earlier vignette, it may be Gehazi. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And he said, Elisha said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And then Elijah prayed and said, "Oh Lord, please open his eyes so that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Please strike the people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elijah said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me. I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. It's entirely humorous. Comment was, it may not be literal blindness. It may simply be not being able to recognize who he is. Or it may be stricken with dumbness, as in gullibility. Because this random guy walks out and says, "Oh, no, 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 you're in the wrong place. Come on, I'll show you where he is." And off they go. So your insight may be correct. It's hard to imagine driving a chariot and all that kind of stuff if you can't actually see. So maybe the old invisibility cloak that gets thrown over Elisha so that they don't recognize who he is. The comment was, all you can think of is the first Star Wars movie where Obi-Wan says, "These are not the droids you're looking for." And the stormtroopers go off in the other direction. Do you suppose that's where they got that scene, is from here? Verse 20. And as soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of the men that they may see." So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria, which sort of casts a bit of a wet blanket over just not recognizing Elisha, because they opened their eyes, and, "Oh, my goodness, what are we doing here?" As I say, I have no idea how this actually went down, but your instinct that marching and driving horses and stuff like that while you're actually blind is, who knows? So, 21. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elijah, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" He answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master." All I can think of is in World War II, in North Africa, the Australians had so little respect for the Italians that when they would capture Italians in battle, they would take their pants off, paint their butts blue, and send them back to the Germans, because they were so ineffective as soldiers that we aren't even going to bother to keep them as prisoners. That's all I can think of when I read this. You've got this whole army there, and they're sitting there looking bewildered. What do we do with them? Should I kill them all? And, no, we'll kill them all. We'll send them back to their master. 23. So he prepared for them a great feast, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Now, I have no idea which king this is on either side. As I say, all these vignettes read like they're self-contained and not really anchored to a time stream. But I find that one great fun. We're not going to go on to Ben-Hadad to pick that up next time.